Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande. Today I will be offering an update on the case of Brian Koberger. The format for this video will be a little more informal as I reflect on the journey of this case now that Brian has pleaded guilty. I'll offer a brief background of this case, including the crime. I've covered this many times. Then I will offer my analysis. This case is pretty straightforward. It involves a man named Brian Koberger. He was from Pennsylvania, but at the time this crime happened, he lived in Pullman, Washington. Pullman, Washington is pretty close to the town of Moscow, Idaho. On November 13, 2022, Brian made his way to Moscow, Idaho, and approached a house at 1122 King Road. This is a rental house that was occupied by six college students at the time. Brian had a knife with him and the sheath that went with the knife. He went through an unlocked sliding glass door at the back of the house, made his way to the third floor. There he killed a 21-year-old woman named Madison Mogan and another 21-year-old woman named Kaylee Gonsalves. They were both in the same room. He then made his way down the stairs toward the second floor. It's not clear exactly what happened next, but he confronted 20-year-old Zanna Carnotto. She might have heard something, like might have heard her friends being murdered, and investigated. That's probably what happened, but it's not clear. Either way, he chased her to her bedroom on the second floor and killed her. He also killed her boyfriend, 20-year-old Ethan Chapin. So four murders from this one burglary, and all the murders were completed with a knife. Madison and Zanna actually lived in the house. The other two were visiting. There were two other people who lived there, Dylan and Bethany. They were unharmed. The 911 call reporting the murders came in hours later, which caused a lot of people to wonder what happened there. There was an investigation. Brian was arrested, and he struck a plea deal. The plea deal was agreed to on June 30, 2025. So on July 2, 2025, just 2 days later, Brian Koberger pleaded guilty to four counts of first-degree murder and one count of felony burglary. He is scheduled to be sentenced on July 23, 2025. Presumably, his sentence will be four terms of life in prison without the possibility of parole to be served consecutively. So Brian will not be getting out of prison ever. When the sentencing is complete, the judge will probably lift the gag order that has been in place for a while, and a lot more information might be released at that point. We'll have to wait and see what happens. There wasn't a lot to learn from the hearing itself where Brian pleaded guilty. The state did talk a little bit about the evidence. For example, they mentioned that Brian's DNA was found on the snap of the knife sheath, and the knife sheath, of course, was found next to Madison's body. They also said there was no sexual component to the crime. That, of course, doesn't mean the motive wasn't sexual. Just no crime involving sex could be identified at the scene. Brian may have wanted to do something like that, but it didn't happen. The knife that was used in the murders was never recovered. Brian did not have a lot of belongings in his apartment, and no evidence was recovered there, at least not evidence that was helpful to the investigation. His car was cleaned meticulously. A prosecutor described it as spotless and almost disassembled on the inside. So Brian was pretty thorough in trying to escape responsibility. Of course, it didn't work out too well because he was arrested, and now he has been convicted through his guilty plea. Now moving to my analysis. I've covered the Brian Koberger case in four videos, not including this one. The first time was right after the murders. It was a massive story at the time. Four young people were murdered at night. It was really unheard of. The identity of the killer was unknown at the time, so a lot of people were on edge. Would he strike again? There was no way to know. The second video was released right after his arrest. There was a sigh of relief. The killer had been caught. The third video I released about a week later. This is when the probable cause affidavit came out and a lot more details were contained in that. A terrifying case kind of came into focus with that document. The fourth video I released over 2 years later in May 2025. So I was watching an episode of Dateline and I saw that Brian had actually watched one of my videos, according to the reporting that Dateline did. He was looking at various videos and mine was one of them. So I thought that was interesting and there were updates in the case other than that, so I made a video. This quadruple murder is one of the most interesting cases in true crime history. It is so unusual and terrifying, and it has gained a lot of interest from the public. As I've talked about before, it's reminiscent of the attack perpetrated by Ted Bundy in 1978 at the Chi Omega sorority house at Florida State University in Tallahassee. That crime also shocked the nation due to the sheer brutality and animal-like nature of the offense. Ted Bundy was called an out-of-control beast, acting on pure impulse and anger. His desire to kill was overwhelming. There's a sense that during those murders, during the attack that he perpetrated there, he just could not get enough. He didn't want the spree to end. So when he attacked the people in that sorority house, he went out and actually attacked someone else as well. Like, he was just on a rampage. To some degree, the quadruple murder that Brian committed had the same out-of-control feel to it. Like when Brian left the rental house after he committed the murders, he almost wrecked his car. Like, he just couldn't control himself. He was panicked or scared or excited or who knows what, but something was going on, and he was not really managing his emotions very well. Brian Koberger had an unusual profile for a killer. He was a PhD student who was studying criminology. He had no criminal record, and he was not a suspect in any crimes. He did not appear to have any prior relationship with any of the victims. And he was meticulous in his cleanup efforts, as I mentioned. But of course, he still made a few key mistakes, like leaving the knife sheath behind. It was definitely a case where the perpetrator did not seem to align very well with the offense. Brian was not the killer that people were expecting. This might explain what happened next in this case. Brian built a large number of supporters who were adamant that he was innocent. And again, a lot of the really convincing evidence was released early on. As I mentioned, there was a probable cause affidavit. So it really wasn't a mystery. Like, this wasn't a whodunit. I think that most people believed that Brian was, in fact, the killer. The case had not progressed to the point where he pleaded guilty or was found guilty or anything like that. But the case was pretty strong. Like, the evidence the state had seemed convincing. There is always some room for doubt, even if that doubt is not reasonable. And I think that's what happened here. Brian's supporters really latched on to very small inconsistencies and unusual occurrences in the case, like the delay in the 911 call. Why did it take hours to notify the police? Four people were stabbed to death. The police should have been called right away. Again, there were two other people in the rental house. That just seems so unusual. The supporters didn't believe that the car captured on video outside the rental house matched Brian's car. They fixated on what they thought was a difference in color. And of course, there were theories about a police conspiracy and a cover-up and things like that. Pretty familiar stuff when dealing with a high-profile case. These conspiracy theories run wild every time there's a case that attracts an overwhelming amount of attention. One might imagine that many of Brian's supporters have abandoned him at this point, mostly because of the guilty plea part. Unfortunately, that's probably not the case. When dealing with people who have conspiratorial thoughts, their belief in conspiracy theories does not change based on evidence, although it might shift a little bit. They might change lanes, but they're still driving on the same road in the same direction. In this situation, some of his supporters are now saying they pleaded guilty to protect a vast conspiracy of officials. This demonstrates how hard it is to change conspiratorial thinking. no amount of evidence will convince a diehard Brian Koberger supporter that he's guilty. He could send them a letter from prison that says something like, "Hey, it's Brian Koberger, the quadruple killer. Thank you for your support. And, by the way, there is no question about my guilt." The letter could go on to state 100 times in different ways that Brian is, in fact, the killer. Like, there's no doubt. And the supporter would be like, "This is part of the conspiracy. The evil conspirators made Brian write this letter." This would only actually deepen the conspiracy for a diehard supporter. It would not discourage them from believing that Brian is innocent. Now moving to my next thought. Many people are upset about the state's decision to accept this guilty plea. Brian avoided the death penalty by taking the plea. Instead, he will spend the rest of his life in prison. It seems like a good deal from Brian's point of view and a bad deal from the point of view of the state of Idaho. It also doesn't seem like a good deal for the family members of the victims, but as I understand it, the family members of three of the victims supported the plea deal. The family members from one of the victims did not. The nature of this plea deal has raised concerns. For example, if this case is not appropriate for the death penalty, what case would be? What does it take for a killer to be executed in the state of Idaho? A quadruple murder is insufficient? How many people does a person have to kill? Can they share with the public what that number is? It just seems like that would be a case which would match the death penalty pretty well, ideologically. Personally, I'm opposed to the death penalty, but I can appreciate that the citizens of Idaho voted to have it available. If this is what they wanted, why isn't the state respecting their wishes? Another concern is that Brian wasn't required to offer any details. There are still so many questions about what exactly happened. What was the order of the killings? Is it what the state believed, the account that I talked about earlier? Was it something different? Did the victim say anything to him that he remembered, that he could repeat, that he could share with people? None of that will be known now. Well, potentially it won't be known. At least it won't be known from him saying it in court. With this case being so unusual, much can be learned from it. Wouldn't this be an ideal case to hear a full explanation of what happened? What were the motives? What were the events that happened in order? What was the thinking behind it? Could Brian tell people more about the planning? Maybe some insight would be gained which could prevent a similar crime in the future. Again, this crime took everyone off guard. It would be nice to have some way to develop some type of warning system. Maybe some red flags that haven't been identified yet would be uncovered if Brian would tell his complete story. Here are my thoughts on this. It probably was a good deal for the state to accept the guilty plea. Taking the case to trial would have cost the state of Idaho over $1 million easily. This is money that could go to more worthy causes. It could make more of a difference somewhere else. One must consider the pain and suffering for the family members who have to go through a trial. All that has been avoided with this plea deal. Weird things can happen in a trial. I think the evidence was convincing, but who knows what a jury might think? Maybe some jury members would have conspiratorial thoughts, and they could poison the rest of the jury. They could become toxic and contagious. Maybe the police made a mistake, and some evidence will be thrown out unexpectedly, like the DNA evidence or the video surveillance. There is always that risk. Even if the trial occurred and Brian was found guilty and the death penalty was the sentence, it can take years to execute a prisoner. Realistically, it would take at least 20 years and possibly much longer, or it might never happen. There is a killer named Thomas Creech who was in prison in Idaho. He was sentenced to death for a murder he committed in prison. His sentence was in 1981. He is still alive now in 2025 as I'm making this video, 44 years later. In his case, to be fair, the state of Idaho did try to kill him. There was a failed execution. They could not get an IV started after torturing him for an hour, stabbing him with needles. Brian's situation would be different. He would be facing a firing squad again, if he went to trial and received the death penalty, which did not happen. The prison would not have the same problem they had with Thomas Creech unless Brian somehow became bulletproof. You never hear an executioner saying, "We couldn't get the bullet started." What about that argument that, as part of the deal, Brian should have been forced to explain exactly what happened? That requirement is an option for plea bargains. The state could have asked for that. They had the authority to include that in the deal if Brian agreed to it. Well, it does not appear as though it was in the deal, so I guess Brian did not agree to it, or maybe the state didn't ask for it. Maybe they didn't care. I don't think it matters too much either way. No matter what Brian would have said, it could not have been trusted. He could lie about his motive, and no one would know for certain that he was lying. After all, he was a quadruple killer. It's also worth considering that Brian is going to be spending a long time in prison. It's possible that he might talk later on. Several notorious killers have talked about their cases from prison. All they have is time in there, so they sometimes get a bit chatty. For example, David Berkowitz, the notorious Son of Sam serial killer. From late 1975 to the summer of 1977, he killed 6 and wounded 7 in New York City. It was a massive case that caused a lot of terror. He used an unusual weapon. It was a bulldog revolver, 5-shot, chambered in .44 special. Not a weapon you hear about every day. He pleaded guilty in 1978. Technically, under his plea deal, he was eligible for parole in 25 years. The deal was highly criticized. Now, I would be surprised if David was ever released. I think his next parole hearing is in 2026. He has them every 2 years. But again, he's probably not getting out. But interestingly, David won't stop talking. He has given interviews. He does a lot of writing. Maybe the same thing could happen with Brian. He's in there for a long time, and he wants to tell his story. He could still be lying, of course, if he did that, but it would not have to be part of a plea deal to get the story. He could just tell his story on his own. As far as kind of looking at all the information in this case at the point that the case is right now, what could have happened? What do I think happened here? This is just a theory, my opinion. I still believe that there was some type of sexual motive in this case. He was probably targeting Madison or Kaylee. I don't know, but he went after them first, so it seems like that's a logical way to think about it. Also, with the murder of the other two victims, it did not seem like that was planned. He was startled after murdering the first two victims. It's worth considering that a sexual motive could have been combined with Brian's educational experience. He might have been fascinated by what he studied in college. For example, one of his classes involved the study of antisocial personality disorder. So maybe he thought about that and started wondering what it would be like to commit a heinous crime. Reportedly, Brian has autism spectrum disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, OCD has an overlap with obsessive compulsive personality traits. So you see rigid thinking and kind of following the rules. These personality traits aren't associated with criminality, but I wonder if Brian became fixated on the topic, like he was thinking about antisocial personality, he was thinking about murder, maybe even murder with a knife, what it felt like, the experience of actually taking a life, and he just could not stop thinking about it. He wanted to know what that felt like. There have been other cases like that, where killers committed murder because they wanted to know what it felt like to commit a murder. Maybe Brian simply couldn't resist, and now he's in prison for life. Now moving to my final thoughts. Is this case finally over? The answer is probably. Brian waived his right to appeal, although technically he could still argue that his defense attorneys did a poor job representing him, like they failed to tell him something important about his guilty plea, so that could get it thrown out. Functionally speaking, the case has been finalized. Brian will die in prison. There is a degree of closure now. That doesn't mean the pain will go away for the family members of victims, but it does mean the uncertainty is gone. At least they have that comfort, for whatever it's worth. Brian was an extremely frightening individual in the sense that he had the potential to be an even more devastating killer than he was. It's hard to imagine causing more damage than he did, but it's possible. For instance, he could have been better at covering his tracks and getting away with crimes. He could have committed several crimes like this over the course of years. There is no way to know if he would have continued killing, but he certainly could have. Fortunately, despite whatever Brian may have believed about his skills, he was no criminal mastermind. Those are my thoughts on the guilty plea in the case of Brian Koberger. Thank you so much for watching. I'll talk to you soon.